Genealogy by Tim, Season 4, Episode 2, recorded February 25th, 2024. Not much news on the research front this month, but I have made some progress with the State Archives of Mykolaiv Oblast, and some progress on the MUMMA transcription project. The big stories this month are OpenStreetMap server software installed on Genealogy by Tim servers, and the Genealogy by Tim podcast is moving to YouTube Music in light of the upcoming deprecation of the Google Podcasts app. All that coming up on Genealogy by Tim. First, some old business. If you caught the podcast last month, you may have heard that I have made contact with the State Archive of Mykolaiv Oblast in Ukraine. This is after writing to them, but first translating my typed text into Ukrainian using ChatGPT. Seems to have been successful. They've written back to me, I've written back to them. They have requested a document of citizenship, and I was able to provide for them my non-driver state ID, and that seems to satisfy them. The reason they want to know my country of citizenship is that they are not serving citizens of Russia and Belarus at this time. Which is interesting because I have a distant cousin living in Moscow who may be quite interested in these documents. I don't think there's any restriction on future sharing of the documents. Or at least I hope there isn't. Because I happen to know some people in Russia who might be interested to see these. This is the birth record of my great-grandfather's brother, Louis Anflik. And this person is similarly related to a gentleman that I know in Russia. In any case, we got to the part where the archivist sent me an invoice in Ukrainian hryvnia, which worked out to about $1.09 in US dollars. But the invoice gave specific instructions to wire the money to a Ukrainian bank account. And this is a new thing for me. I have never wired money internationally before. First, I tried Western Union, but they're mostly for sending money person to person. And you can pay bills through Western Union, but only to companies that are registered with the site and whose names appear in a drop-down list of recognized payees. And the State Archive of Mykolaiv Oblast is not in that list. I had similar trouble with other sites. There's a site called EasyPay UA, which handles Ukrainian payments. Apparently you need a Ukrainian telephone number to use it. That would have been the best bet for online payment of international bills. And this is all very new to me. If I sound inexperienced in this matter, you're right, I am inexperienced. I am figuring this out as I go. And in the absence of any useful help from websites, I went ahead to Wells Fargo Bank and opened a bank account. Why Wells Fargo? Well, I already had some student loans there, so they already had my information. Those loans have since been transferred out and are now with another servicer. But since Wells Fargo already had all my information, I just went ahead and opened an account with them. And they do international wire transfers. You know, my current bank, the one I do most of my banking with, is the Police and Fire Federal Credit Union. I called them and asked them about this, and they said they didn't do it. So I went ahead and opened a new account at the Wells Fargo Bank, and I used their online interface in attempt to have this money wired to the State Archive of Mykolaiv Oblast. One difficulty was that the minimum amount I was allowed to send through the online interface is $10, which is about 10 times as much as I need to send. Well, I sent it anyway. And on top of that, there's a $25 fee. I ended up spending $35 to wire $10 to Ukraine when the invoice was only for $1.09. And this is my first time doing it. I know if you're listening and you're an expert at this, you're probably thinking, wow, you could have done that way easier. I'm sure there's a way. If you know a way, please let me know. But this is my first time doing it, and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to send the money out and see what they say. So it took a while. It was over the long weekend, the three-day President's Day weekend. But once business was back up and running on Tuesday, my wire claims to have been completed. Now, the web interface warned that if you don't do this correctly, you could possibly lose your money. which is interesting. The way the transaction now stands, from Wells Fargo's point of view, the transaction is complete. I emailed back the representative of the State Archive of Mykolaiv Oblast, who's handling my case. I notified her that the transaction was apparently complete, and if it looks okay on her end, I hope to see this document, the birth record of my great-grandfather's older brother, Moshe Leib Anflick, from 1876. Now, one possibility is that the representative will get back to me and say, no, sorry, we didn't get any money on our end. And if that happens, I will go to the bank and see if I can have someone do this in person, someone who knows exactly what all needs to be entered and where to enter it. But there is an additional charge. It's more expensive to have it done in person at the branch rather than online. So it could be $40 or $50 to satisfy an invoice for a dollar. But we'll see. We'll see how it goes. And I asked this representative of the State Archives, you know, $10 was the minimum I was permitted to send. Do you suppose the additional money could be treated as an advance payment on future documents? Because I have about 15 documents that I want to get from them. This $10 payment should get me about 9 of those 15. Hopefully this week I'll hear back. I think they typically write back early on Mondays. I'm recording this on Sunday night, so I'll be eagerly checking my email tomorrow morning to see if my international wire transfer went through and if the archivists found it to be satisfactory and if they will release my document request. In other old business, work continues transcribing information on the descendants of Peter Mumma, my, I believe, seventh great-grandfather. But he's my immigrant ancestor who arrived in this country before it was this country in 1748. As you may recall from previous episodes, I've been going through the data posted at mumma.org and adding it to my own, with a link back to Mr. Doug Mumma's website for every profile that I create from his information. The only lines remaining to transcribe are those of Christian Mumma, born August 30th, 1791, and died July 22nd, 1866, and his brother, Jacob B. Mumma, born February 13th, 1801, died November 17th, 1899, in Newtown, Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. I've been working this month on the descendants of Christian Mumma, and Christian Mumma is a grandson of Peter Mumma, the original immigrant, through the elder Peter Mumma's firstborn son, Johannes. So these are the only two lines I have left to do. Christian and Jacob, both children of Johannes and grandchildren of Peter, the original immigrant. And these are taking a long time. It's just every time I scroll down that list of names, it looks so long, it looks like it'll never get done. But the others have all gotten done, so these will get done soon. And next month's podcast, the March 2024 podcast, will have been a year since I started doing this, simply transcribing information from Mr. Doug Mumma's website to mine. I can only imagine the work that it took. Decades must have been that it took for him to compile all this information, if it takes me a year to simply transcribe it. Now, funny thing happened. I started transcribing the descendants of Christian Mumma, believing that his descendants would be living out in Ohio near where my uncle lives in the Dayton area, so that when I go out visit him this summer, all that genealogy will have been entered and ready for us to go cemetery hunting and all that good stuff. Christian Mumma died in 1866 in Clark County, Ohio, so that made sense. But the people I really wanted to transcribe, the people who are actually in the Dayton area, they are descendants of Jacob Mumma, who died in 1889 in Newtown, Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. So it was a little bit of a fake me out there. I thought I was getting my Ohio people all taken care of. But the ones I really want to get done before the summer, those are Jacob Mumma's descendants. And, you know, I really don't want to do more than one thing at a time. I really want to get through Christian Mumma first, and then we're going to get to Jacob. And hopefully that'll be done before the summer, so that by the time I get out to Dayton, the Dayton area, I can say, hey, look at these people. I've been through the lists. These are the people. If we want to go out for a day trip and take some pictures in the cemeteries while I'm out there, these are the people that we'll be looking for. The Mumma descendants. Descendants of Peter Mumma, my immigrant ancestor who came to the New World in 1748. I hope to be wrapping up that project soon. So that about wraps up the research portion of this month. Again, not very much, but I'm hoping for a breakthrough pretty soon, at least on the Ukrainian archives research. Turn now to a couple server-related issues. One of them is that I am experimenting with self-hosting maps. And the idea is part of me running my own server is data independence. So basically, I am not relying on others to keep my data secure, keep my data safe. I'm not paying for that service or paying for as little of it as I have to. I like to do as much as I can in-house on my own server. And one thing I thought was really cool but haven't yet implemented on my own server was maps. And I have two maps that I'm quite fond of, and these were created with originally the Google My Maps Android app. Google has since shut down the Android app and now rely completely on a Chrome-based web interface for the map. It's mymaps.google.com. And I use that service to create two maps that I really like a whole lot. One of them is the travels of my grandmother's great-grandfather, William P. Harrison, as he fought in the Civil War in the 109th Pennsylvania Infantry. And then later, in the 111th, when the two were merged, William P. Harrison served under Moses Veal, Captain Moses Veal, who in 1899 delivered an address at the unveiling of the 109th Infantry's monument on Culp's Hill at the Gettysburg Battlefield. He gave an address that basically narrated the history of the regiment from enlistment in Philadelphia, through the battles of Antietam and Gettysburg, and then into the South, where they participated in Sherman's March to the Sea. Pretty much every location is mentioned, whether they stayed there for a time or battled there. So I took this address and mapped it out on Google Maps, put little icons where certain events happened. William P. Harrison was injured. Gunshot wound to the hand. He lost a finger. He was sent to hospital. Returned after a couple weeks. All of that's mentioned in the map. And you can follow this map from place to place, beginning to end. That's one of my favorite maps. And of course, I'll link to that in the show notes. You'll get to see it. That's one map I really like. The other map that I really like is I have plotted pretty much every gravestone I've ever visited. So if you go to this map, if you show up to the cemetery one day and the office is closed, you can just look at this map and I've got a pin right on every gravestone I've ever visited. And I really do like these two maps, but in the spirit of data independence, I'm looking for a way to self-host these maps. And there is a site, openstreetmap.org, that can be the key. Now, individuals can sign up and log in to OpenStreetMap and make edits. It's kind of like a Wikipedia of maps. And that's not quite how I want to use the information. I want to borrow, let's say, the free and open source information from OpenStreetMap, host it on my site, and put my own little pins on gravestones, Civil War sites, things like that. So in researching how to get OpenStreetMap maps onto my website, I stumbled upon two different map server softwares, and I'm checking them out, testing them out on my site. The first one I tested out is OpenMapTiles. If you go to openmaptiles.org, it says right there, open source maps made for self-hosting. That's what I want to do. And this was my first test. I found this to be very easy to spin up. If you know anything about Linux file structure, Linux servers, I just downloaded this, spun it right up, it was boom, it was there. No errors, no let me go back and check this, it's there. Now, you can actually go check this out for yourself at maptiler.com. www.genealogybytim.com. And what you'll see when you go there is tiles, all right? Basically, large segments of maps. And the map I've chosen to test the site is Street Map of Pennsylvania. If you go to the site, it says Open Map Tiles. There's a thing that says Preview. You click on that, and it puts you, boom, right in the middle of Pennsylvania somewhere. And you can zoom out to get a good look at the whole state. This is just the first stage of my setting up the server. This site is not intended to be visited by end viewers, but the Pennsylvania map that's there is intended to be embedded in other parts of the site. So if I ever get that running, I'll be glad to let you know about it. That was one server software that I experimented with this month. And there's pros and cons to it. The pros, A, very easy to set up. I was done in a few minutes, okay? I'm pretty much ready to move on to the next step and get this map of Pennsylvania embedded into my site. What I didn't like about Open Map Tiler was there was a lot of upselling. So the basic map was available on the site for free download. But if you want any interesting map at all, it's like, hey, join our plan. They warn you that the open source free version of the map server software is for individual use only, but if you want to use it on several computers or if you want to use it for a commercial purpose, you have to pay for a license. So while this map server was really easy to set up, I kind of felt like the people providing the software were kind of keeping me in this box where if I ever wanted to go commercial, I'd have to run it by them to make sure I'm doing everything in accordance with the license and all that stuff. Great software, very easy to use so far, but there is that aspect of it. That's the one server that I spun up. The other one is simply called mapserver.org. This one looks a little more free and open. Looks like they're not warning anybody. You know, hey, if you use this on more than two computers or if you use it for a commercial purpose. I mean, it may be in there. I didn't, you know, scour the whole thing, but it's not. Like, I didn't have to go through a gauntlet to download things. But I found this server to be a little more difficult to install. And the reason is my shortcomings of knowledge with Apache configuration files. So if you know how to set up your Apache virtual hosts, it shouldn't be too bad, but for me, I was kind of new at this, and I had a lot of trouble. It took me several days to get it to a state where I could start loading some maps into it. And you can go to maps.genealogybytim.com, and you'll see a little message there. Right now, it says future site of a map server installation. But I'll link to all this in the show notes. But there's a specific spot where the maps are supposed to be loaded, and even that is showing an error message. It's maps.genealogybytim.com/cgibin/mapserve. It's in the show notes. And at this time it says, load params, web application error, no query information to decode, query string is set but empty. And if you look in the manual, it says, well, that's what it should say the first time you spin up the server and there's no map data in there. So, okay, I guess it's ready to go. Now, they have a demo site that you can install and allegedly run. I tried to do that, but it appears like the demo is for a few versions back and it doesn't load anything correctly. So you can see this server software, it's a little more free, a little more open, but also a lot less user-friendly. So it's taken me a while to get something visible on there. So those are my two choices. That's what I'm wrestling with now to get my own self-hosted maps up on my site. I got to choose eventually, see which one I like best. Either the easy to use, spin right up, but subject myself to upselling and license restrictions, or power through the user-unfriendly mapserver.org and hopefully get some software running that's a lot more free and open. And again, I shouldn't say user unfriendly, but you do need a little bit of web administration experience, a little more than I have, or I'm getting it in the process of setting this up. So stay tuned, and within the next couple months, maybe I'll have some self-hosted maps coming at you from my own web server. For our final full segment tonight, Google will be shutting down its podcast app in April of this year, 2024, and transferring the podcast functionality to a section of its YouTube Music app. Podcasters like myself have to prepare for the change. At first, I didn't think there was any easy way to do it. I thought I'd have to make videos for my 30-plus episodes and upload them to YouTube. But last month, Google came out with a tool whereby podcast creators can link to their RSS feed, and then the YouTube site would take care of the work of creating the videos and posting them to the podcaster's YouTube channel. So far, the only ways to listen to this podcast are direct RSS feed from my website. And this used to be the way that we all listened to podcasts back in the day, back in the mid-2000s. If you wanted to hear a website, you looked for that little RSS feed, that little orange symbol, and you copied the feed location and you put that in your podcast player, whether it be G-Potter or Juice or something like that. That used to be the way to listen to podcasts, RSS feed. I don't know if people do that anymore. It is up on my website that way, if you still do it that way. But the trouble is, if a lot of people do it that way, it'll cause a lot of strain on my server. I don't think my residential setup is really designed to have all kinds of people listening to audio at once. The Google Podcast app compiles information about the podcast, but still passes the audio right from my server. So even if you are on the Google Podcast app, Google is not hosting that audio file. That's still being hosted on my server. But with the coming of YouTube Music being the host for podcasts, that's going to change a little bit. YouTube is now going to make still image videos out of the podcast icon and have them up on YouTube. And that'll be good for me because that's less strain on my server, more people watching or listening. It's funny me saying that right after me saying, hey, I want to be more independent. Here comes YouTube Music making YouTube videos of all my podcasts and hosting them on YouTube servers. But hey, I'll take it where I can get it, you know? Maybe one of these days I'll have myself a full business class server and internet connection where I can host all my files professionally on my own, but until that day, I'll take a leg up from YouTube Music to host my audio files. So as I was saying, at first I didn't think there was a way to do it, and then last month Google rolled out a feature where you can submit your podcast feed and then it would go ahead and make videos for all the podcast files and upload them to YouTube and put them up as a podcast in a playlist form. So I went ahead, it was about a month ago, maybe more, that I used this feature. And one thing you need to have for the feature to work is you need to have your email address in the RSS feed somewhere. And then YouTube Music will contact you at that email address and say, hey, is this your podcast? And then you click yes, it is. And then they'll continue with the transfer. I did not think this was going to work, because I was getting a little idle spinning processing icon for weeks. I'll come back every couple of weeks and look at it and would still say processing, processing, processing. So I think, is something wrong here? Do I have to, you know, cancel this and restart it? But just last week, boom, the processing was finished. And many of my podcasts are now on YouTube Music. For some reason, I think it only went back 10 episodes. I don't think it got my whole output. So if you want to go back and listen to those early episodes after Google Podcasts shuts down, you may have to get them from the RSS feed on my site. And the real test will be whether this podcast is successfully uploaded and posted to YouTube Music. That'll be the real test to see if everything's ready for the final handoff from Google Podcasts to YouTube Music this April. So cross your fingers there. Hope everything works out okay. We'll still be on Google Podcasts right up until it shuts down. But that's only going to be in a couple months. You're going to get a March podcast. You might get an April podcast. But by then, I kind of need to know what's going on with YouTube Music, whether we are ready to go going forward. It's a little bit apprehensive, a little bit anxiety-inducing, especially more so as the end draws near for Google Podcasts. But we'll find a way. Even if we have to branch out to other services, we'll find a way. And that just about wraps it up for this month. Last thing I want to do is give a shout out to Lisa Louise Cook. She's back. She had been gone since July, but just posted a January and a February podcast. And I love these podcasts. When I go out for my bike ride to the monthly meeting of the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania, I like to hear her voice on the podcast. So that'll be good. I've said last month she was missing in action. I haven't heard from her, but she's back, ladies and gentlemen. Go check her out. Genealogy Gems, LisaLouiseCook.com. It's good to have you back. And for everyone else, I will be back next month with my updates, what I've been doing, and what I've learned, and I will talk to you all then next month. Until then, keep on digging. Your next family history adventure awaits.